broadcast for shooters, hunters, and gun enthusiasts. This is the Firearms Radio Network.
Welcome to the Reloading Podcast here on the Firearms Radio Network. Tonight, we have a special guest, Derek Peterson from Peterson Cartridge Company. He's going to tell us about the process that they use for making precision brass. But first, let's start off with what we love to do, which is what we've done in firearms and reloading and Second Amendment stuff this week. So, Derek, since you're our guest, if you'd like to share anything you've done this week.
Anything I've done this week.
Well, obviously.
Besides making brass.
Yeah, okay. That counts. Besides making brass.
All right. Then all give right, us come how many cartridges did how many rounds of 308 did you make this week?
Probably somewhere near 35 or 40,000.
Hey, you know what? I like this guy better and better every second.
And Jim, since you're so talkative this evening, what have you done this week?
Actually, most of the work I've been doing is on working on developing the 1,000-yard range I've been telling you guys about. That's basically it. I did a little bit of 9mm casting earlier this week and did some 9mm reloading, but I'll tell you what, I'm beginning to hate 9mm. And as far as the Second Amendment goes, well, you know, you guys know that I created the Facebook group NRA, and it's the major Facebook group of that's named NRA. There's another one, but they only have 5,000 people. We've got 40,000, but whatever. Wow. Jason, you used to be an admin in that group. You know exactly what I'm talking about.
Yep.
Anyway.
Yep.
Every day I live, eat, and breathe, walk, talk, and sleep. Second Amendment, guns are reloading. I'm not a gun freak. I've never harmed a soul in my life. I've never pulled a gun on anyone either. But I do like my guns.
Jason, how about you?
Yeah.
Another one of those lovely long overtime weeks.
It was another one of them. And we got rained out today, so I didn't go shoot. I was just trying to think. I don't even think I went to the store or talked or did anything.
That's not fun.
Slacker. I think I was a gun nun.
Jeremy, since you were, you know, slacking, you're next.
I actually had a fairly busy week. Started out by replacing my bench. I went from a 6-foot long bench, 2-foot wide, to a 12-foot long bench, 3-foot wide. And I was able to get all my stuff set up on there. I did some coating of some cast bullets that I made. And I actually received a this thing called Fast Brass. I played with it a little bit, but it's a machine that basically has all your stuff on it, but it's not quite set up like a RCBS or one of those prep machines. Everything's perfectly in a line. It's really nice. I mean, it does the brass really, really fast, which I guess that's why it's Fast Brass, but it's a super nice machine. What else did I do this year? Oh, I took my daughter out hunting yesterday. We had a youth weekend deer season open up yesterday here in Arkansas, and yesterday morning was kind of slow, kind of rained on us a little bit, but my daughter, she made up for it yesterday afternoon. We actually had a doe and a buck walk in on us, and she dropped the doe, and the buck stuck around, so I told her to go ahead and drop him too, and she did. So she dropped a doe and a buck all within the span of about 2 minutes with her .243 that she actually reloads her own ammo for. She's 11 years old, and she reloads all her own hunting ammo. She's been doing that for a couple years now, reloading her own hunting ammo. But she used her .243 that she uses in competition, and it worked out really good. She didn't have a full square on broadside shot, so she popped them in the neck, and they both dropped where they stood. So I was pretty happy about that. I was pretty tired last night after I had to skin and clean both of them. But
that's good shooting.
It's definitely some memories made. So.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I was pretty proud of her.
God bless that young lady. I love her. I love her to death. Nice.
She's actually going to be, I'm working on some .223 loads for her to shoot in competition next year for F-class. So she's a pretty good shot for 11-year-old girl.
Well, I'll tell you what, something for you to think about, Dad. Maybe one of these days we'll get that young lady on the podcast.
Yeah, we'll have to do that. We'll have to do that.
All right, Mike, it's your turn.
I didn't do a heck of a lot this week. I've been busy with other stuff, so I didn't get a chance to really do anything. Did get a chance to crank out another 100 rounds of 40, but that was about it. So, been a busy week. Although I do have a confession to make. I let everybody down yesterday.
Really? How'd you do that?
I went to Cabela's and didn't buy a thing.
Oh, that's not a disappointment.
That's a tough feat to do.
That's tough to do.
Yeah.
That's quite a challenge.
Yeah, I didn't buy a thing.
Are you on the 12-step program or what?
No, my wife's foot's only a size 10.
No. I've done that a few times myself, and it's like, dang, I feel kind of cheated or something. I don't know.
Yeah. There is one thing I'd like to do.
Yeah.
Yeah. We can't discuss that on the air, Jim.
Oh, Jeremy knows exactly where I was going.
Oh, this is going downhill fast.
You forgot to tell us an important detail, Jeremy. What did you have to do to that rifle?
Oh.
Oh, yeah.
What did you have to do?
Why? I was putting on the – I'll tell the whole story. Friday night – or Friday afternoon, I was getting all the hunting gear together for my daughter. I was putting the sling on, and I got the front part put on, and I rested, like an idiot, I rested the barrel on the stove handle for the oven door. I went to put on the back, the sling on the stud, and the barrel fell off and hit the ground. I had the rest of the gun in my hand, but I mean, it hit pretty hard. I felt pretty bad, so I'm actually kind of happy she didn't shoot anything Saturday morning, because I was able to take it out Saturday afternoon before our afternoon hunt, and I rechecked the zero. Luckily, it was still on zero, but talk about feeling bad if it had been knocked off and she had went to shoot and missed Saturday, because I mean she's a pretty dang good shot. She generally outshoots her mother. So I had to recheck the zero. Luckily it was on. So I felt so bad about that. I was trying to figure out ways where she could use my 7 mag or my 30-30 or something.
Give her a few years to work into that 30-30.
Yeah, I did that Friday.
We gave Jeremy all kinds of crap on Hangouts about it. But, you know, it's like, it's what funny because he knew the minute I spoke up, there is something I want. And there he is just groaning. Oh, Jim, you have to go there. All right. Anyway, good job, Jeremy. I'm really proud of you, bud.
Thanks.
Yes, sir.
Well, Jeremy, why don't you give Derek a full introduction, since it was your work that kind of brought about this whole thing.
A full introduction. I think it was Tom. He contacted us, which kind of set this whole ball of wax and gear here. I mean, it just where it actually led 308 brass test. Starting with Peterson, I wanted to see how basically all the 3-0 brass compared with each other, and I was extremely, extremely pleased with how the test came out. Some surprises came out, but the Peterson brass I tested was just absolutely wonderful. And even the brass that I got sent, I went in there and cherry-picked, or, you know, just kind of picked at random at cases, and I did that with everybody that I tested, but pleasantly surprised with how Peterson brass came out. Extremely, extremely consistent.
Yeah, I'm glad the result showed that. Very, very glad.
And the big thing that I noticed on the test that actually was huge was the consistency and the case capacity compared to, you know, other brass and whatnot. Is extremely consistent. I think on my test, there was only 0.4 grain difference between the lightest and the heaviest as far as case capacity, which, you know, like I do, you're looking for that case capacity consistency when you're long-range competition shooting.
Yeah, you know, it's surprising how many times I've talked to folks, and the first question they ask me is, so how much is the greatest, you know, what's your greatest difference between your lightest case and your heaviest case? You know, if I order a box of 25, and, you know, I'm happy to give an answer about that. But what I more lean towards is what your work shows, is that it really doesn't come down to your casing weight. It comes down to your your case capacity. The way I try to explain it, which I mean, I know all you guys do and your listeners probably do too, but in case some of them don't, you know, any kind of rifle casing is basically a sealed pressure vest. So if you put the exact same amount of, you know, in our case, propellant inside of it and you seal it up, and it gets ignited exactly the same way, and it's the, like I said, it's the exact same amount of propellant. The volume is going to be your main determining factor as to how much pressure gets built up inside the casing. And so, if there it's a smaller volume, if it's a larger volume, it's gonna, you know, it's gonna directly affect that. And so I was glad to hear your hypothesis that you explained on the podcast where you mentioned us, that you took that into account and you had the correct hypothesis, in my opinion, which was that, if you have greater swing in your highest and lowest internal volume, that's going to make much, much more of a difference than if your casing weight, total weight, is higher or lower. You know, so many things go into effect. The casing weight, it's not just how big's the chamber on the inside of the casing itself. It's, so if you took a thousandth of an inch more off when the casing gets trimmed, or when the extraction groove gets cut, you end up taking a half a thou more on each side of the casing and of the extractor groove. It makes a huge difference in your external weight, but it might not necessarily have anything to do with how the casing itself performs.
Exactly, and I've tried to explain that to other folks that are getting into, I guess, long range shooting is you can explain away a difference of weight, as in different metals. There's more metal in the case head. There's those two particular things is mainly the stuff I come up with is the different metals being used in the alloy mix. I mean, most of the time it's 70-30, but you can still get a difference of mixes depending on what manufacturer you go with.
Oh, absolutely. You know, it's all in the U.S. Most of the manufacturers use scrap to make their, you know, they melt down scrap. Sometimes they get impurities in there and other type of, problems associated with the brass. And that can make a difference in the weight. You know, I guess you might not have given any thought to this at all, but if someone was trying to have a measurement of a casing, reflect the capacity, so which measurement on the casing reflects the consistency of the internal volume more than anything. Most people don't know, but check the webbing thickness. That's it. There's no great way to check the webbing thickness, but checking the webbing thickness will definitely is a better measurement.
Oh yeah, definitely.
How long have you been making brass? Not you personally, but how long has Peterson Brass been making brass?
We're new. We've been making brass. So the company got founded, and I guess it was the beginning of 2014. We had the idea at the end of 2013, and then we started up production March of this year. So relatively new. I mean, very new.
Wow, that's great. And now I understand a little bit more about the product line you have. Now that I see, now that I know that.
So you're trying to develop new products and get the word out on your current ones, try to build a following, and you guys all know about that. So.
Oh, yeah. We followed every step of the way, every jot, every tittle, every I, every T that Jeremy went through when he was analyzing all this brass. And we're really thrilled that such a new company like yours came up on top when it came to quality and uniformity, precision. That's the word I'm actually trying to use.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
I appreciate that. You know, that was what we set out to do. When we were looking at our machinery, a lot of the making brass comes down to what kind of machinery you have. And and when I was doing my research, so I personally did all the research, it was on our website, which is kind of fun. We've tried to. I designed our website last year, I guess, in 2014. And my goal is to make it informative, actually drive people to the website to learn something if they so chose. And so I don't know if you've been on our website or not, but I have shown all the steps in making a rifle case. I've laid it all out there, and I've shown our quality control procedures. And it's fun. You know, we sacrificed speed to achieve accuracy. The old style machinery it makes about 220 parts a minute. We make about 22.
Yep.
But as you can tell, those casings that I sent you, those weren't hand picked. Those weren't hand sorted. They weren't weighed. They weren't anything. They came off the end of the line, they got put in a box, and they got sent to you.
Those cases, they looked up like they were just boxed up, but I was really, really impressed with them.
I was glad to hear it. Seeing your spreadsheet, man after my own heart, we have a whole bunch of them, you know, for studying our competitors as far as hardness and capacity and everything else goes and external dimensions. And so I was glad to take a look over your spreadsheet.
Now, has y'all's numbers, did they kind of jive up with the numbers that I came up with?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Awesome.
Yep. And so that was kind of, it was nice going into it. We kind of figured we had an idea where we were going to land, and it was just good to get confirmed for us. We spend a lot of time studying the hardness, which is a huge factor in reloadability and also not having a critical failure on your first firing. So we spend a lot of time studying that and our competitors and ourselves. So it kind of worked out pretty good.
Awesome. Yeah, all the cases that actually form that spreadsheet, I'm planning to continually fire them until, you know, I get case, but, you know, like a split neck or something like that. Or if it looks like I'm going to get case head separation, of course, it's going to get pulled early. So say a competitor like me that, you know, bumps the shoulders back, you know, 1/1000th of an inch and then kneels, you know, after every firing.
We have no idea how long they're going to last.
I could possibly get a lot of firings out of that case.
Yep, I have no idea. It all comes down to how much overpressure and if any you do, and so that takes a toll on the casings, of course. But
yeah,
we've shrunk our primer pocket to about the lowest acceptable size that the industry accepts, and so they hold up really well over repeated firings. You know, even if no matter who you're shooting, you know, our studies show that no matter whose casing you shoot, primer pockets expand 6 to 7 10,000ths. Every time. On the first firing. 6 to 7 10,000ths.
That's right.
And then, so ours do the exact same. So if you start out at 20.2074, 2075, which is where we are, and you expand, say, 7 thou, 2081, if you're starting your second firing, you're 2081. So if someone starts out at 2084, 2085, which is mil-spec minimum, they're still larger on their first firing before the first firing than we are after our first firing. And the brass primer pocket expands substantially less after the first firing, between the first and second and third and fourth.
Mm-hmm. I noticed that when I was hand priming them. I noticed they were nice and tight.
Yeah. That's definitely not by accident. When we first started making them, we were at the upper end of mil-spec, 2095. And at 2095, yeah, they fit fine. Time you put them in. But after that, it's hard to shoot them in a semi-auto, like an M1A. Mm-hmm. They wanted, every time the casing hits the ground after getting ejected, that primer goes one way and the casing goes the other. So we shrunk it down to 2084, and it still wasn't tight enough. So then we, you know, before we decided to go any lower than 2084, 2085, because that's outside of mil-spec, we measured everybody in the industry, made a spreadsheet, again, just like yours, and figured out, oh, that's where everybody is. Everybody's below mil-spec. That's how they do it. So,
well, you see, that's just it. Military specifications, mil-spec. Everybody thinks that, you know, the whole world needs to run mil-spec. They even think that mil-spec is quality. No, it's what the military orders.
Correct. And, you know, they're staking their primers, too. So they might make it 2085 or 2093, but they're staking their primers, so they're not going to fall out, you know, so they can be fired through a fully automatic.
Right.
And that doesn't exactly work the best. You know, hardness on your mil-spec chart in the sidewalls is substantially lower than what the long-range distance community is going to put up with, because if you shoot a mil-spec casing that's just straight up mil-spec and you overpressure, you know, we're talking 3,000 feet per second on a 155 grain bullet, like a full bore bullet, you're going to end up, sticking in your chamber. They're not going to come out. Vast majority. Mm. That's what we.
Well, that's the other. There's another major point to this that I'd like to reiterate in this particular conversation, and that is the fact that the military makes their own ammunition to fit their own specifications. They do not and are not required to follow SAMI specifications.
That's as I understand it.
That's right. Those are the facts.
And if you think about it, most of the military ammo that's made, it's going to get fired once, and the case is going to, you know, it's in the sand somewhere.
It gets left on the ground. Yeah, it's designed, you know, I forget where I was reading, but it was like 90-something% of all casings that get fired by the, you know, all ammo that gets fired by the military is in practice. And so it ends up just getting fired at a piece of paper at the range, and then it gets, you know, thrown back in the barrel, in the scrap barrel. Yeah, wildly different than what long range community's doing.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, we look good. Try to get as many firings as we can out of a case. You know, like me, you know, I'm shooting for my 1,000-yard load, I'm shooting a 178 grain bullet, and I'm running it up around 2750, 2800 feet per second.
Yeah.
So. It's pushing it pretty good, and you know I look for you know primer pockets like yours, the Pooh, that you know nice tight primer pockets where you can get a lot of firings out of it instead of you know because if you shoot 1,000 to 2,000 rounds a year of 308, you know at $70 per 100, you know it can get kind of expensive. You've got to replace them every other match or so.
Yeah, it gets a little spendy there.
That's a fact, but that's the other thing too. Not only, you know, it goes that way too, but remember there's those among us that are a little bit Scottish in nature. We're called reloaders. That's the real reason why most of us got started in this. We're trying to save money.
So what you're saying, Jim, is you're cheap.
Well, yeah, Mike, I said I'm Scottish.
Frugal.
No, frugal. I am ethnically Scotch-Irish, okay? So I'm a cheap bastard. I don't care. Anyway.
That's funny. I think one of the questions I had that I come up with is when are y'all going to come out with 223 brass for matches?
That's a great question. Understandable. So our machinery, so short answer, not soon.
Okay.
Unfortunately, because our machinery runs, when we bought our machinery, we had to choose. We want to have fast production and low accuracy and then have to hand sort everything. Mm-hmm. We want to have slower production, much greater accuracy and precision and consistency from casing to casing, and then not have to necessarily hand sort everything and weigh everything. Not that we don't 100% inspect, because we do, but we're not weighing every single casing and grouping them in boxes according to their weight. And so because the machinery runs, you know, substantially slower than the new machine, it's not cost effective. It wouldn't be fair to the shooter for the price we'd have to charge them to make 223 brass, if you know what I'm saying.
Okay, yeah. Well, I'm definitely glad y'all went the latter, because, I mean, it was very consistent, the brass that I tested.
Yeah, that was the whole goal, you know, was to get into it and make match grade brass. Brass that there's no good competitor to Lapua here in the States. There's just not, in my opinion. And because of it, yeah, everybody buys their brass from Finland. Mm-hmm. And I hate to see that there's not an American source for really good brass. You know, it shouldn't be that way. That, you know, we have, the Americans have to go and buy brass from a foreign end, because it's the best out there. There should be an American option, and that's what we're trying to do.
Exactly. And I would definitely put it up there with brands that are made in Finland, for sure. I mean, it's up there top notch. So
I appreciate that. That's what we were shooting for, so I'm glad the numbers showed that.
May I ask a question?
Any question you like.
Thank you. I would like to go the other direction. When are y'all going to consider getting into 30-06 caliber, not the exact caliber, but that dimension, that shoulder to head dimension casing, that family? When are you going to get into making maybe those cases? Well, I actually own a 280 Remington Ackley Improved, so you understand where I'm going. Well, the case head's a .473 diameter, and, well, you understand. That's why I'm just curious. When are you going to get into that size?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm glad you brought that up. So every casing has a parent casing for the most part, whether it's your 7mm 08 or whether it's your 270 or your 280 like you had talked about, or even your 260 for the parent casing being the 308. We haven't had any plans yet to move into the 30-06 head diameter family yet. There is some truth to, once you know it's harder to develop the basic tube than it is to develop the necking down process, which is what that comes down from, making a casing out of a parent casing. So we don't have any plans into the 30-06 yet. We've committed into being in the 308 family, and we've committed to being in the 300 Win Mag family. So the options for the 7mm Rem Mag, you know, other calibers in that family. And then we made the jump into the 338 Lapua, which, unfortunately, it's becoming a very popular caliber for the long distance community, and has been. But there's not a ton of, there's no comparison in the offshoot calibers like there is to in the 308. So That's kind of what we, those are the head size, casing head size, you know, the parent casings that we've invested in so far.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate that. No, and no problem at all.
Yeah, no, and, you know, I was talking, we've been getting a lot of requests for the 6.5 Creedmoor and even the 260 Remington, and we're, you know, every time we get a request like that, we're trying to be as nimble as we can. And listen to what our supporters and our shooters are saying as far as what calibers they want. And once we get enough, we generate enough buzz around a certain caliber, we'll end up committing to it. That's for sure. I can tell you that for sure.
Awesome. I got a buddy that shoots a lot of 300 Win Mag that I told him. I said told him to look y'all up.
Yeah. I appreciate that. We should begin production on the 300 in the beginning of 2016. We're going through development right now on it, and so that's been fun doing the grain structure analysis and trying to figure out the banding operation. You know, at what point in the manufacturing do you make the band and all the other little nuances associated with, you know, making rifle brass. Especially belted calibers.
Yeah, definitely.
So, Derek, why don't you share the history? What got you into this in the first place, and kind of the steps of, you know, from when you guys were sitting around and this idea came about to when you actually got up and running?
Sure, yeah, I'd be happy to. So it was in the fall of 2013. So my father and my uncle are my business partners. We have a parent company that they run, and we own a different factory, and they own a different factory and some other different companies that are unrelated to manufacturing. And so we were out. I remember what I was helping them start up one of our other companies that we purchased, and I was sitting at my desk and we were talking about going hunting. And so he said, well, we got to pick up some ammo, and we both shoot 243. He was always a 30-06 man. He started hunting in the 60s and 70s, and so he was loaded for bear, you know what I mean? 30-06, best caliber around. You know, you can take a bear, take an elk, take a deer, it's good all around caliber. So he transitioned over to the 243. So we were looking for 243 ammo, and he couldn't find any. It was in kind of it was the tail end of that ammunition bubble, that craze that went on. And so the shelves were empty. They'd been empty for most of a year or more. And, he said, well, why don't you look into seeing what it would take to make ammunition? And I'm not scared of a challenge, so all right. He talked me into it. So I went to work on it and started doing some research, and that, you know, included figuring out, okay, all the steps in making it, and okay, now that you know most of the steps that are involved in making it, what kind of machinery manufacturers are there out there? So we searched high and low, looked at all the old style, the 1940s style manufacturing equipment, and tried to determine, okay, do we want to make a ton of casings, you know, really high speed, or do we want to be accurate? Okay, so do we want to buy into that whole big ammunition craze bubble thing? Like, are we going to, you know, pour all of research or resources into trying to capitalize on that shortcoming, or are we going to be in this for the long haul? And so my stance has always been, we're in this for the long haul. We're not going to go into just mass producing ammunition to fill a shortcoming. That seems like a pretty short-sighted idea. And so we said, all right, well, let's do long distance, high precision, rifle casings. And, so I searched, like I was saying, I searched around for manufacturers of the equipment. Yeah, the equipment. Try to figure out, okay, so which one do we want to get? And we found one out of Utah, and did a whole bunch of research on them, came and visited, and decided, okay, this is where we want to spend our money. If we're going to spend, you know, millions of dollars doing this, let's go with the best option we got. So we picked a company out of Utah, and so I spent the next year and a half after we decided who we were going to choose for manufacturer of the equipment that makes the brass casings. I spent it learning all the different quality steps that go into making ammunition, but casings. So what kind of skills do we need to be good at? What kind of in-process QC do we need to be good at to make good casings? So I purchased a laboratory, a complete laboratory. So we have an internal ballistics lab in our facility where we can get and do internal pressures and velocities. And then we built a laboratory. I built a laboratory that does metallurgical analysis. So grain structure analysis, micro hardness of the casing, head and side walls, and all the preparation that goes along with that. So I guess I've probably talked for 5 minutes now without anybody else chiming in. Is there any questions up to that point? Is that everybody on track with that?
Oh, yeah, I'm finding this interesting.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay, good. So then when the machinery was about ready to be started up, I moved out here to Utah. I kind of packed up everything that I owned into a U-Haul van and kind of set sail for the West Coast from Pennsylvania, because that's where we're from, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And it took 3 days to drive out here. I got out here and set up shop, built a kind of a makeshift facility out here in Utah, surrounding our manufacturing equipment. And I've been kind of running out here ever since. We've hired the shop manager and brought him out. And we've hired a lead operator and brought him out. And so it's getting a little cramped in our two-bedroom apartment. I was sleeping on the couch for a while. so we've kind of expanded a little bit there. But then we've just been running, trying to get the bugs worked out, trying to produce the best brass we can. Taking it slow, making sure we're doing every possible quality check you can think of to ensure that we give ourselves a good name right out of the gate. We've always said, you're not going to get a second chance to make a first impression in this industry. It's a very tight-knit industry, and it's a closed industry for the most part, in my opinion. And if you do somebody wrong, sell them bad, shoddy product, they don't forget. So that was kind of what we knew going into it. So that's basically where we stand now in a nutshell. I hope that answered your question.
Yes, indeed.
Awesome. Yeah, you're right about the long range community, because word spreads fast at those matches, national, just state championships and all that, because everybody's talking about, hey, what load are you using? What load are you using? And I mean, we always talk about cases and primers, all that good stuff.
Yeah, that's been fun. We kind of developed a beta testing crew that we figured, okay, so we can do every bit of testing ourselves, which we do as far as metallurgical and ballistic. But some of it's just going to come down to shooting hundreds and hundreds of rounds and to make sure that it's performing correctly. So we developed a kind of a beta testing crew to test our brass, and we send out brass to them, and they shoot it around and do all that kind of stuff. And so they give us pretty good feedback as far as if we're having overpressure signs and issues, so we can tweak our casings and whatnot. You got me thinking about that at Matt Hawk. And so.
Well, I know one place that bad news travels even faster. It travels at the speed of light, and that's on the forums.
Yeah.
Like the reloading room, for example. That's essentially what it is. But, you can't be in this market. You can't be in this game. As competitive as it is, you can't be in it if you're not going to make a good product. If you do make a lousy product, you're going to go stone broke.
We're firm believers in that. At our other factories, okay, we make things that can't fail as well, like casings. We make parts that go in air-to-air missiles and fighter jet ejector seats and medical equipment and things like that. And so we're very familiar with the quality aspect of it.
Derek, I hope you didn't think I was throwing out negative aspersions your way. Please forgive me.
No, not at all.
Okay, thank you.
Not at all. Not at all, yeah. I just agree with your sentiment.
Well, we do get exposed to quite a lot of the reloading business and the business, the ins and outs, stuff like that. I do have a rather personal question, Derek.
Oh yeah, sure, good, yeah.
If you don't mind.
I don't mind.
It's reloading related. Now, by now, I'm sure you know how to load and make ammunition. But when you first started this, did you actually know how to reload ammunition?
I knew how to reload. I had no idea all of the steps that went into making rifle casings. It's been overwhelming, to say the least. When my business partners came and said, look into making whole rounds, I was saying, I'm fine with that. But the more and more I learned about it, the more I came to the conclusion of, let's just try to make brass. let's forego this whole rounds idea, loaded ammunition idea. Let's just stick with brass. It's going to be hard enough for us to make good quality brass that doesn't fail the shooter and is truly match grade. To that sentiment, it's been very, very difficult. I mean, it's taken all my brain power and all of our shop managers' brain power and all of our lead operators, my business partners' brain power to keep on top of not producing any shoddy product, because there are a lot of opportunities to make mistakes. We should say that.
Very good answer, sir. Very good. Thank you.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Mike.
That was Jeremy, not me.
Well, I was just going to ask personally, what all? Do you reload for all your rifles, like hunting and shooting or plinking or whatever?
So I had reloaded kind of for fun. I had my buddy's dad reloaded, and I got to hang out with him and reload a little bit here and there. So we were always boxed ammunition. We bought from the big four, the big five, because we were just shooting, you know, whitetails at 30 yards, you know, in the Pennsylvania woods where you can only see about 30 yards. And so I'm not going to act like I had ever done any kind of F-class shooting or anything really extreme like that. I hadn't. I was an avid shooter, killed many, many deer, you know, 20, 30 deer. And you know, we used to get some farm tags, and so I could kill multiple deer every year. But I had never done any kind of long distance shooting like
that. Awesome. And then to get into making match grade brass that's consistent as it is, that's awesome.
Yeah, I've had some good mentors along the way. I don't want to make it sound like I have done this all myself. When I first decided, okay, we want to make brass rifle casings, not steel brass, I enlisted the help of the smartest guys I could find. I knew enough to know how dumb I was. And so I went and I got a hold of the guy who wrote the most current version of the ASTM standard, which is the metal industry's, authority governing body, the ASTM. And he wrote the most recent version for cartridge brass. And so I reached out to him. He lives in Illinois. And I called him up as a sub-30-year-old kid, basically, and said, "So this is what I'm trying to do. Can you help?" And to my astonishment, he said, "Yeah, and not only can I help, I got another guy who used to do some consulting work for the military, the government ammunition plants in Lake City, and some of the other big rifle and gun rifle and ammunition manufacturers. And they came and visited me in Pennsylvania and saw my lab and gave me all kind of advice on, okay, so if you're going to do grain structure, this is how you're going to want to do it. If you're going to do micro hardness testing, this is how you're going to want to do it." And they gave me a lot of pointers and opened my eyes to, okay, son, if you really want to do this right, this is how you're going to do it. So I don't want to make it sound like I did everything myself, because I sure didn't. I've had a lot of help along the way from a lot of really good people.
You just put a big smile on my face, because you, the college graduate, shall we say, listen to the old guy with the 45, 50 years experience. Thank you, Derek.
Yeah, they've blinked away more experiences than I've had, especially when it comes to the metal industry like those guys have. And there's, you know, brass, and a lot of people, when we were investigating, I kind of left out the part where we went and traveled around the country. We were in 28 states in 2 weeks in 2014.
Oh, wow.
It was pretty awesome and pretty awful all at the same time. And we went and visited all of our potential customers. I mean, door-to-door salesman kind of thing. Like, so if we're going to make brass, would you buy? And a lot of the guys we went and talked to said, "All right, yeah, if you make good brass, we'll buy." But keep in mind, making brass is like black magic. It's like it's alchemy, you know, turning things into gold. And I kind of was astonished at that statement. You know, it's like alchemy. I thought it was going to be like science, and it is like science. It really is science. I mean, if you do the exact same operation to the exact same material every single time, you will get the same result. Brass is no different. And so it was important for me to learn how to verify that. A big one, you know, learning that just because some sheet that you get your brass, you know, with that says this brass is C260, you know, 70-30 of cartridge brass, it actually is 70-30. That was a big learning for me. You know, just one of the dozens, hundreds of learnings that I've had, thousands of learnings that I've had, is that just verifying your raw material. That's a big part of what we do.
Awesome.
Most impressive. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I can see how you definitely would want to definitely test your raw materials going into it. Because, I mean, you got, with 308, you got 60,000 PSI of pressure, you know.
Yeah.
Hollow chamber.
Yeah, if you make a mistake, you know, I've been real lucky with my business partners. They trust me pretty well. And when I've said, hey, I want to go visit a vendor, they always say, okay, go for it. So when we bought our universe receiver, I said, I want to buy this universe receiver, but I want to visit them. And they said, okay, get on a plane, go. And when I said, you know, I want to buy cups from XYZ vendor, they said, all right, get on a plane, go. They sent me to Europe to visit a vendor for raw material. And I was saying, I think I can get the best cups in the world, but I'm not sure. And I know it's important for us to get the best cups in the world, but I think I found them, but I'd like to visit. They said, get on a plane, go. So, I've been really, really lucky, and they've trusted me with getting the lab set up, do all the testing that we need to do to verify our quality to our customers. You know, we're going to put our name on. If my last name's going on, it's going to be good. It's going to be right. And if it's not, I really want to hear about it because I'm going to make it right. Is my stance.
Well, there's another point in your defense, Derek, that you haven't even bothered to mention, but I'll mention for you. And that's the fact that, you know, if you're buying brass by the truckload, buying brass cups by the truckload, let's face it, you have a substantial investment in your raw material itself. And you certainly don't want to take and lose that. That's one of the most important reasons why you need to keep testing that stuff.
If you can't outperform your raw material, and that's a definite, that's a truth in a lot of industries, all manufacturing, and this one's no different. If you start off with shoddy raw material, you're going to end up with either manufacturing problems, in process manufacturing problems, or defective product at the end. That's just how it's gonna happen. And if you have a high iron content, I'm talking 0.005% kind of high iron content problem, you're gonna have problems with your finished product. And so there's just a lot of those nuances and kind of trade secrets that we didn't know when we had to get. And the only way we got it was through help from other industry professionals.
I thought I knew a lot about reloading, but boy, oh boy, oh boy, I've learned a lot from you tonight.
Yeah, and you know, when we're back in Pennsylvania, I'd love to have each and every one of you guys come and visit, and if you're in the neighborhood.
You're
and
on.
Show you, yeah, we
you're I'd on. Show, I am from, I am originally, I lived in Burgesstown area for about 25 years. Yeah, so I know where I'm talking about.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not there now, but I'll take you up on that.
That'd be great. I'll personally show you guys around and show you the process, and we can talk the talk and all that stuff.
Sounds good.
Awesome.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, I mean that too. Seriously, if you guys want to come and visit, I'm always happy to have you.
Yeah, I'm only 3.5 hours from Pittsburgh.
That's easy. That's nothing.
That's right.
Sound like you need to put something on your calendar there, Jim.
Sounds like a wiener, Jeremy. Sounds like a wiener, Jeremy.
Good God.
Oh, sorry about that. This is a podcast.
We have a lot of fun on here, Derek.
Hey, and there's nothing sacred.
No.
There's nothing sacred. Jeremy talked about one of the most painful injuries I can imagine. And we just said, well, tough shit. We ain't going to take care of it. They ain't going to give you no slack.
Yeah. We're not pulling any punches here.
Yeah, no, we don't either.
Good deal. But yeah, I'll take you up on that someday, Derek.
Yeah, sure.
So, Derek, are you temporarily in Utah, or are you set up to do business out of Utah?
We're temporarily. So we're kind of disjointed right now. We've got, I don't know if that's a good word, but I have a factory back in Pennsylvania that we share with our sister company, the manufacturing company. And there's space waiting for us to just plop our machines in, but I refuse to come back from Utah until everything's perfect. I'm not doing it. I'm gonna. It's kind of rough being out here and being away from everybody, but I've been out here since Feb of 2014, and what's another couple months? I'm not coming back till we're everything's perfect. So.
So, other than the big project of moving back to Pennsylvania, what's next?
So what's next? In the interim, we have a couple bugs that we're still, process improvements that we're trying to work out on our machinery. We're waiting on a couple of the die developments to get finished up for the 300 and the 338. But then as soon as that that comes through. Those are the big things, small things. What's next? I get to go back to Pennsylvania for deer season for a first opening day on the day after Thanksgiving. So I'm looking forward to that. That's on the short term, but I didn't know if that was what you meant or not, but that's what's on my calendar.
Hey, hunting's always good.
You bet.
Yeah. One of the questions, I don't know if your reloaders would have any interest in this or not, but I get asked a lot about the quality process, you know, the in-process quality checks that we do. Is that something you guys would want to hear about, or is that?
Absolutely.
Okay, good. You want me to just go ahead on that then?
Yeah.
Okay.
From the time the brass hits the door.
Sure, yeah. So the brass hits the door, comes in the loading dock. We get a certificate of what it's made out of. We take a couple samples. We send those off to an independent lab to get them verified for their metallurgical composition. So, you know, everybody knows C260, right? So that's the ASTM symbol for our, or, you know, name for our brass. It's actually cartridge brass. So it's 70% copper, 30% zinc, and it has some trace elements in there. So we send it off to be inspected, to make sure it is what they say it is. We then do some micro hardness testing. We, you know, slice the cups in half. And this is all, if anybody wants to get on our website and view this all, I took the time and I must have spent a fortune getting all the pictures taken. But I've laid out our in-process quality procedure, inspection procedure on our website, so you can go through it with that's petersoncartridge.com. And so we cut the cups in half. We do micro hardness testing, and then we do grain size analysis, because that has a huge factor in how the casings, how the cups draw out into casings, is if their grain structure is correct. And grain structure is tied to hardness, but it's not a one-for-one. And so we look for, we're looking for grain structure. So once those tests are done, so we've done our metallurgical composition analysis, we've done our grain structure analysis, we've done our micro-hardness testing, the cups go in, we go into first draw. So then they're measured after each one of our draws to make sure that their sidewall thickness is correct and there we don't have any kind of substantial runout problems. We then go through all three of our draws. We do in-process annealing to soften the brass. Some most people know, but brass work hardens. And so the only real way, commercially effective way to harden brass is to work, at least C260, is you work it and it gets harder. So after first draw, it couldn't go right into second draw. It has to be annealed. So you anneal it, and then you go into second draw and anneal, go into third draw. And then we go in and do our pocketing and heading process. And like I was saying, brass, it can only be hardened by moving the material. So we go into the heading process, and so the heading puts our name on the bottom. It also hardens up the bottom of the case to get your head hardness and your primer pocket hardness. So we do in-process inspection, like I was saying, you know, the cups, and then through the out the draw process, making the tube, and then we do hardness checks on the sidewalls of the tubes to make sure, because once the tube comes out of the third draw, it's as hard as it's going to get because it's not getting worked anymore besides the taper operation. So we do a micro hardness check on the head after pocket head, and then we go over and cut the extraction groove, and we're doing all of our measurements. You know, this is where our external measurements really start kicking in. So you're going to measure your extraction groove, your head diameter, your head thickness. Then you go into taper, and you end up having a measure. So you measure your length to shoulder, and you're going to measure your run out, make sure that a casing doesn't have any kind of substantial run out. And then you'll go into punch your flash hole. You'll cut your length, and you're trimmed to final length, and you're going to check your cut to make sure that it didn't have burrs on it. And then you're going to check your flash hole to make sure you don't have any burrs on the inside, because they get punched. Ours get punched from the outside in. And then you go over to your final anneal to soften up the mouth again. So then we measure at the end of the line, we measure a micro hardness, you know, hardness testing on the head and the sidewalls and the mouth. Make sure there's no stored up tension on the inside of there, on the mouth, because that's what causes them to split. If there's any kind of pressure stored up in, or tension stored up in that, the annealing relieves that. So then they go over to our inspection process group, and they do 100% inspection on them. So they're checking to make sure that the flash holes got punched and make sure that, you know, the big stuff, the length's correct, the flash holes got punched, and that there's no visual defects on the casings. You know, we're talking light scratching, if that, if a die got chipped and we have some kind of scratching in the sidewall of the casing, or we have dings in the head or any kind of, you know, problems like that. And they also do the chamfer on the casing mouth at that time to make sure there's no burrs for you guys that, that reload them. They don't rip off your bullet jackets and cause problems for you when you see you. You know, they do the final chamfer, and then you end up packaging them up, put them in you know, 25, 50, 100 count boxes, and package them up for the OEMs, and away they go to be loaded and shot.
Now I have a question.
Yeah,
I was wondering, do y'all deburr the flash hose? Because I was looking at the cases that I was in, and I mean, you know, I mean the flash hose, I mean, I couldn't tell if they were drilled or punched.
Yeah. We do that intentionally. We do deburr the flash holes.
Okay, that's what I was thinking. You know, when I got them and tested them and, you know, was taking all my measurements and stuff, and I was like, you know, I was looking inside the flash holes because, you know, 9 times out of 10, your average Joe reloader out there isn't going to deburr the flash hose. Yeah. As competitive shooters, we were extremely OCD and want everything consistent, and, you know, we generally neck turn and we deburr flash hose, we uniform primer pockets, and I mean, I even put up some questions in the reloading room to try to find out what a majority of the reloaders do, because, you know, when I do my brass prep, you know, I go to the nth degree to make sure everything's consistent, where, you know, you can take cases and do all kinds of brass prep to it to get it more consistent and batch them into groups by case capacity and all that good stuff. But with, like, the Peterson brass I tested, I mean, you could take this stuff straight out of the box, load it, shoot it, and it's going to be consistent. I mean, just based on what I saw in the flash hole, you know, not having to deburr them, not, you know, the brass is so consistent in the box as far as case capacity that, you know, Peterson brass is like the burger bullet of brass cases. You know, a lot of people brag on the burger bullets where you can just pick them up out of the box and load them and shoot them. You know, and I noticed the same thing about the Peterson cases was that each one was so consistent, and you didn't have to go through, I wouldn't have to go through all this brass prep, which would actually save time as a competitive shooter. And that way I wouldn't have to sit there and go through all the brass prep. I'd be able to just load them up and shoot them, which I really like that. I mean, that was really nice.
Yeah, we have a machine that deburrs flash holes for us. Right now we're working on getting it to do the casing mouths as well, so the gals don't have to do it. But right now, yeah, we have a machine for that.
Awesome.
I heard you mention you have like 50 and 100 batch increments that you sell in.
Yeah.
When I was just on your website, it looked like you had 50 only. Are you just out of the hundreds at this point? Or
let me think about that. I might have misspoke. I think, yeah, if you order 100, we send you 250s. We are going to do a 100 count box. We decided to just send 250s, 50 okay. count boxes, yeah. That's my, I miss.
Where are the price breaks, assuming that there are any?
The price breaks are really built for the OEM customers, the ones that are going to order 100 and some thousand rounds.
Okay.
However, I did get an email from my accountant in advance of this podcast, and he instructed me to let your listeners know that if they go onto our website, they can use our promo code Reload10, and you get 10% off your next order.
Oh, yay!
Yeah, I was saving that for the end.
Way to go, Jason! You blew that one, didn't you?
Yeah, really. See, we're all brutal. There's no two ways about it.
No, it's good. I'm glad we got it out there earlier. Yeah, Reload10, get 10% off.
Appreciate that.
Very nice. Yeah. We do.
Yeah,
except for people named Jason Trumbo.
That's
all right. Jason will just make his wife Kathy order it for him.
Yeah. And my kids and my dog.
How his dog got a credit card, I have no idea.
It's been one of our goals has been to, kind of as an aside, one of our goals has been to really try to, you know, live close to the guys and gals who are actually using our brass. And as an aside, if any of your reloaders shoot our brass, or any of you guys shoot our brass, want to have any insights for us, or any kind of experiences, you know, this is what happened when I shot your brass, and I'd like to see this changed or that changed. My email address is dpeterson@petersoncartridge.com. You can call me anytime. You can email me anytime, and I'm happy to talk and answer any questions that you guys or any of your listeners, followers, want to ask. That's, I think, one of the things that we're trying to make ourselves different and better, some of our competition, that you can still go to the owners and you can ask any questions you want.
Awesome.
Very nice.
That definitely makes a difference when you feel like you're being heard, for sure.
Yeah. We're happy about it, and we encourage anybody who buys a brass or is looking into buying our brass to give us a call. We'll answer any kind of questions you want, whether it's internal volumes or, you know, averages or measurements or, you know, that kind of stuff, or estimated reloads or anything like that. We're happy to talk.
Any final things you wanted to say to the listeners? Seeing Jeremy's list, I'm just a deer hunter, but I'm definitely going to be picking up some brass when I do my next set of loads this spring. So I've gotten to the point where I've got about 10 rounds left, so it's time to make up some more.
Yes, yeah, about that time.
I was really impressed with the quality of the brass, and decided that instead of just using some of the stuff I got laying around, I'm going to actually get a little more serious about it. So,
yeah, that'd be great. We're always looking for new customers, as you can imagine. So, that'd be good.
Anybody else have any final questions?
Not that I can think of right now. Sure, I will.
I would just pleasantly impressed with the fact that Derek is from my old stomping grounds.
We won't hold that against you, Derek. It's all right.
So Derek just proves that there's finally somebody decent that came out of that neighborhood.
Oh.
CIR.
No punches pulled.
No, not at all. What part of Pittsburgh were you guys situated?
We're in Cranberry, just north.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah.
I'm actually
I'll just go say right off I-79.
Yep, right off I-79. And my family's actually from Erie, Pennsylvania, near Erie. It's called Corey, Pennsylvania. That's where I grew up.
That's where we go shopping.
What?
We go shopping in Erie. I live way up north in Pennsylvania, a little bit of town. Have you ever heard of Bradford, PA?
Oh, yeah, I know Bradford.
Yeah, I live about 25 miles southeast of Bradford.
Oh, nice. Oh, you're definitely close enough for a factory visit.
Yep, absolutely.
Kind of do a fun thing because, you know, on the manufacturing scale, having to do it all day. We have a diamond chop saw. We must cut in half 30 casings a day. Just cut them in half and do our measurements.
What a waste of good brass.
It is a waste of good brass, but however, I wouldn't be as confident.
That's right.
Yeah. I'd rather waste 30 pieces than send out one bad one. True. I'd rather waste 300 pieces, 3,000.
Sounds like a winner to me.
Now, let me ask something off topic. You're not a Steelers fan, are you?
This is going to sound bad, and I'm going to get ridiculed if anybody in Pittsburgh listens.
You already have been. You forget it. You forget it. Mike, let's just go somewhere else.
I'm going to say something you didn't expect. I didn't grow up with watching any professional sports. I've probably watched less than 5 professional sporting games of any sport in my entire life.
Oh, wow.
And so I don't watch any.
Oh, wow. That's big up there because, I mean, the Steelers are huge up there.
It's fighting words. It's not just big. It's fighting words. You know, however, if I go into a bar, you can guarantee I'm a Steelers fan. I guarantee black and yellow.
Told you were smart.
Well, I need to send you a Cowboys hat.
Oh, sure. Did you really have to get profane?
Hey, Jeremy, what's the Cowboys record against the Steelers in Super Bowls?
I don't know. I'm talking reloading right now.
You got me all flustered. I was talking reloading. And
score.
Join the crowd, Derek.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah, they played today, though. I think Steelers played today. They're playing the Oakland Raiders, I thought.
Yeah, unfortunately, Roethlisberger went out again.
Did he? Yeah. My roommates are watching it when I left. The guys, my shop manager and my lead operator were watching it when I left to go into the office at about noon. They were like, you want to watch the game with me? And I was like, I think I'm going to go do some paperwork. Right. I'm going to go count cups. I'm going to go see if there actually is 100,000 in that container.
In other words, you wanted to do something that was going to be less painful.
Something less painful.
Yeah.
Oh, that's funny. Well, pass on my hello to...
This is a reloading podcast.
Yeah.
And that's why he went to work.
Yeah, that's why I went
He went to work on reloading stuff, making brass.
Sorry, Jeremy, we did cut you off. Apologize for that.
No, I was just going to tell Derek to say hi to Tom for me. I've spoken with him quite a bit through email.
I will do. He's a good guy, ain't he?
He seems great over the email, yeah. He seems like a great guy,
When you get to the factory, I'll introduce you. And you'll like him just as much in person as you do over email. He's a quality guy. We were very lucky to find him, as well as our accountant Andy and our shop manager Tom and our lead operator Jim. We were been very, very lucky and selective in finding them, and I'm sure glad we found them. They do a great job for us.
I had to throw a shout out there to him. I mean, he kind of got this whole ball started with the 308 test.
I think it's a good test. You know, I've been considering publishing our hardness findings that we get, because we've hardness tested everybody. I don't know if I will or not. We might just do an average on our website. I'm not sure yet, but I'm sure glad that someone's doing the testing that you are. I think it's going to help the reloaders. It's going to help long distance shooters. I think you're going down the path of debunking some of that case weight myth that there's always been. The casings are the most accurate are the ones that weigh exactly the same. That just doesn't necessarily hold true every time.
And that's kind of the goal I was after, was debunking that myth.
It's a strong myth. It is a legitimate belief that a lot of people have.
It is. It is. It really is.
They'll stand by it. And so for me, it's like, how do you say it? Lapua or Lapua? You know what I mean? And so it's six one way, half dozen the other. And like you guys were saying, to crimp or not to crimp on your other podcast.
Oh, jeez, don't start a fight. Oh, my God. 1911 versus Glock battle. Here we go.
Yeah.
No, but if you're Finnish, it's Lapua.
Yeah, it's French.
And if you're American, it's Lapua.
Yep. Either way, they make some pretty good product. I'd be lying if I was saying that they don't make good product. I would be lying. They do make good product. I respect all of our competitors. I really look up to a lot of them. You know, Winchester, Remington for how big they are, and Hornady for what Steve Hornady's done over there. I sure do respect them guys a lot. So we're privileged and felt lucky to be included in the study that you guys did, and I'm glad we came out near the top. So
by any chance, would you be attending the NRA annual meeting next year in Louisville, Derek?
Ooh, I know we're going to SHOT Show. We have a booth. Okay. We're downstairs. Anybody's welcome to come and see us. We'd love to have you. It'll be me, myself, and Tom, and some other business partners. I don't know if we're going to the NRA show. I'll have to check on that. Okay. I've been they keep me out of the loop on that stuff. They just keep me out here in Utah. They just say, make the brass and make sure it's good. Send it back to Pennsylvania. So that's kind of what they got doing.
That's why they put you on planes and send you to Europe and other places around the country, huh?
That's what it is. They know I'll go, and they know I won't gripe about it at all either.
There you go. 28 states in 2 weeks. Oh, my God.
Yeah, it was that was eye-opening. The other thing, I guess, that was really eye-opening for me was the rate at which our customers and anyone in the industry, how friendly they are. I've worked in other industries, and these guys in the gun industry, oh my gosh, if you know, they'll give you the shirt off their back. They'll if you got questions, you know, we've had a lot of questions of our customers, like, hey, what do you want to see in a casing? You know, what attributes are you looking for? What kind of quality problems have you seen in others? They just tell you.
So, you asked.
Yeah, you asked, and they'll just tell you. That isn't the same in other industries, and I'm so glad.
Yeah, there is a certain amount of political, you know, of non-politics and whatever,
yeah,
in out there in the industrial world.
They, I got kind of the best advice I've gotten in a while from, I think it was one of our competitors. He asked me a question, I told him an answer, and I said, so in some other industries, we wouldn't have been that honest with each other. And he said, this is a fun industry. Let's keep it fun. You know, at the end of the day, we're making rifle casings, all right? We're not making widgets. We're not making ball caps. We're not making, you know, chapstick. We're making gun stuff, you know? So keep it fun.
Exactly. In the big scheme of things, we're all on the same side anyway.
Yeah, we're all on the exact same side.
Oh, I'll tell you what, it's great to see a new industry get off to, or a new business get off to a good start like yours.
I appreciate that. I hope we can keep it up. I'm confident we will. And again, I don't know if we are wrapping up. I sure do appreciate you guys having me on the show. I know I can be long-winded at times and talk too fast at times, but if you get me excited about something, I'll go.
You're fine.
Yeah, absolutely.
Tim's that way.
Not me.
You don't talk nearly as much as Jim does.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, at least he's not as quiet as you are, Trumbo.
I'm just listening. I'm a good listener.
That's why your wife calls you troublemaker, huh?
Hey, he didn't say what he listens to. He just said he's a good listener.
Exactly. Listen to the voices in my head.
If I'm ever too quiet in a room, people start coming and looking for me because they know I'm up.
Uh-oh.
That's funny.
I got into making my own black powder a little while ago.
Ooh, that'd be fun.
Oh, that would be
fun. Oh, yeah. Wise man. Wise man.
It was, but you can come pretty close to blowing yourself up pretty easily making your own black powder. So all I was getting on was if I'm ever too quiet, I'm in a room, look in the corner, I might be making some black powder.
Dangerous children. Gotta love them.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Well, we definitely thank you for coming on, and I look forward to having you on again. So when you get ready to launch your next round of brass.
That'd be fun. That's a good idea, Mike. I'd like that a lot if you guys want to do that.
Absolutely.
Yeah, we might be having something coming out sooner than I had originally planned on. I can't really speak to it just yet, but it could happen here relatively soon within the next month or two. We could have another caliber that we didn't really plan on having, but I'll leave it at that, I guess.
That's a nice surprise.
It was a nice surprise. We have some big info coming out at SHOT Show this year, too, for the ultra-long distance shooters. I'm talking ultra-long distance shooters. Mm. So that'll be, I can't give any more than that, a little teaser, I guess, but it's coming out. It's going to be kind of big for the industry. I think it'll be kind of
awesome.
Big.
Just remember, folks, you heard it first on the Reloading Podcast. Yes, I quite agree with what Mike said. Thank you for coming on, spending hour and a half of your time with us. Hour and three quarters. Appreciate the time, sir.
Yeah, and any time. I'm always glad to be talking to you guys and being on your show. Thank you for it, and have a great night, guys.
You too. Thanks.
Sure, thanks, for-
thanks, Derek.
Talk to you guys soon.
Sounds good. Thank you. Right. Well, folks, thanks for tuning in. Hope you learned a little bit about how a company goes about starting up in the firearms industry, and especially making precision brass. So the spreadsheet is on the reloadingpodcast.com webpage. There's a link that says files and stuff. It's on there. Otherwise, it's also on the Reloading Podcast Facebook page, or you can get a hold of one of us and we get it to you if you can't find it otherwise, to Jeremy's wonderful experiment. And keep in mind, folks, that's continuing. It's not done yet. This is an ongoing process.
You bet.
All right. So folks, if you're shopping and you're shopping Amazon or you're shopping Brownells, swing over to the reloadingpodcast.com. You can do it from your mobile device or your regular desktop or laptop computer or your tablet or even a Chromebook. Click on the affiliate links. It only takes a couple seconds and it doesn't cost anybody extra money. And it helps out the network, helps out the show. We thank you. We noticed people have been going over to the Brownells a little more. And so we want to thank everybody for using the Brownells link. And we definitely want to thank everybody for the continued use of the Amazon link. So thank you very much for that. It does help. And if you have any comments, concerns, complaints, questions, we did get a couple in the week. So those we're going to address on the next podcast. And with our guest ran a little long tonight, so we don't want to make this a super marathon. But next week we'll go over some of the comments and the questions and things that we like to bring up. So we do thank everybody for sending those in. A couple of ways to get a hold of us. Reloading@firearmsradio.tv is our email address. You can swing over to the Reloading Podcast Facebook page, post on there. You can message us on there. Or if you go to reloadingpodcast.com, the show notes, there is a spot to do comments. There also is a link at the end of the show notes for all of our Facebook, Google Plus links for all of us individually plus the show and the Reloading Room. If you have a question that you want answered on the show, post it in the Reloading Podcast Facebook page. If you have a question you need an answer to like now, then go to the Reloading Room and post it there. But you may want to, especially if you're doing it from a desktop computer or laptop of some sort, when you go to the reloading room, use the in-page search function, because somebody may have asked it already, and that might save you some time. So there is no such thing as a stupid question unless you're stupid enough to not ask it. Keep that thought in mind, folks.
I've been known to foam at the mouth when I hear, can I ask a stupid question? There ain't no stupid question if you don't ask it.
Yep. So ask the questions. I guarantee you at some point in time, even the most experienced reloader has thought, hey, wait a minute. So ask the question. It's better to ask and get the answer than to not ask and have something go tragically wrong.
Get the wrong kind of answer.
Yeah.
And we also are pretty good about preventing the wrong kind of answers from getting out there.
Yes.
We have a great team of admins in the reloading room, and they are alert, intelligent, sharp, and they have the authority to do what they need to do to keep you trolls out and to keep you idiots out that deliberately give bad answers to newcomers. We don't put up with that trash. Nope. Well, there's one guy on this podcast that I...
Bite me.
Oh, you took that bait, Jason. Hook, line, and sinker.
Oh, that was funny.
He knew I was going to slam him. Oh, now how did you know that, Jason?
I felt a disturbance in the force.
Experience with me trashing you every day probably had something to do with it.
Maybe.
Yeah, it's been best part of 4 years.
Has it?
Yeah, because I remember opening up the reloading room in September of 2011. You know, I changed it from the secret group that I created to the public group. I think it was late August or early September. And we just exploded in growth or whatever. No, I tell you what, folks, I do tear Jason up unmercifully and sometimes unnecessarily, but it's all in fun. Jason takes his cheap shots when he can get them, stuff like that. So we're pretty good friends as far as that goes. Jason and I think a lot alike.
Scary.
What? It that is? You think alike or that you think in the first place?
Both.
Double slam.
Both.
See, I gave up thinking. It hurts too much.
Yeah, I tried that once. My skull swelled up.
Wrap this puppy.
Do it. All right.
So, folks, keep your brush shiny.
Keep your powder dry.
Aim small, miss small.
And squeeze. Don't yank that trigger.
Gotta squeeze it, Sonny. Squeeze it gently.
You've got to treat it like a lover. You've got to press on that trigger so lightly that you could put the petal of a rose in there and you won't bruise
it. No. Make it stop.
You just want to caress it.
The president of the Firearms Radio Network wants us to record a commercial for our show.
What are we going to do?
I don't know, man. It's like I'm freaking out over here. What should we do?
We could talk about our guests, some of the great people that we've had on the show.
Like gun manufacturers, part manufacturers, gun personalities on YouTube, people who write books about guns, TV personalities, all these different things. But I don't know how to put that into words.
Yeah, or the fact that we're funny, but we're informative. I mean, how do we get that out there to the people?
I don't even know. It's like, how do you explain that we're going to make you laugh, but we're also going to teach you how to build an AR-15.
Yeah, I'm lost on this one, man. We are screwed.
I don't know what to do. I mean, if I had to put it into words, I'd say something like a hilarious podcast about guns, gear, gadgets, and the issues that affect responsible gun owners everywhere. Howard Stern for the gun world.
That's perfect. Hey, if you want to hear it or find it, where do you look?
WeLikeShooting.com/show.
I'll be there.
I'll be back.
Welcome to the We Like Shooting Show, episode 106.
This has been a production of the Firearms Radio Network. You can find more information at firearmsradio.tv.